Ever-relevant, ever-changing, used to be called grunge, now tagged Beverly Hills rock band Weezer, has released its sixth full-length album. That was the opening track, Troublemaker. The band has sold 10 million albums since its first release in 1994, but Weezer's tried to stay low-key. They even kick off their album tour with a BYOI, that's Bring Your Own Instrument, Town Hall-style hootenanny, and yes, they called it a hootenanny. Rivers Cuomo is the frontman for Weezer. He joins us from the Malibu Performing Arts Studio, where much of their new release, The Red Album, was recorded. Mr. Cuomo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And I have to ask first off, any relation to either Mario Cuomo or Three Rivers Stadium?
None that I know of.
Right. Look, you have, I believe in past interviews, described yourself as, I think the phrase is a control freak. You've been the sole songwriter for your other five albums, but this one was more collaborative, wasn't it?
Yeah. Let's see. My drummer wrote a song and sang a song and got to play guitar, and I went back and played the drums for him. And my bass player wrote and sang a song. My other guitar player wrote and sang a song. So we got to switch things up and face some new challenges this time. So it was a lot of fun.
It was nice to shake up the old formula?
Oh, yeah. It's always nice to shake things up and try things you've never tried before. That's what it's all about.
Let's listen to a track, Dreamin', which is kind of written in the sonata form. I'm dreaming.
I love writing songs, and I'm always looking for new things to try, and one of the toughest things is structure. It just works when you use verse, chorus, bridge, and as soon as you become aware of that formula, you start to have a bad conscience when you write with that particular structure. So I've been looking for new forms I can write in, and that's one of the things I was trying on this album, and I thought of the sonata form from classical music, and I figured, well, it's probably not going to work, but I'm going to try it anyway and try to make it work. And the angels in the heavens, they are wondering, why am I so glad?
Begin to see yourself as making a life in music?
I wanted to be a pro football player when I was a little kid, and it wasn't until I was about 11 or 12 that I learned I had some physical disability. Turns out I was going to be on the small side, so I probably wasn't going to make it in the NFL.
You have not to embarrass. Wait, one leg is taller than the other?
Yeah, one leg was longer than the other, and a doctor said, you know, you're going to top out about 5'7", by the way, and that's when I started to realize I wouldn't make it in the NFL, and had one or two years of sadness and confusion.
Yeah.
Thought about being a comic artist, but then the hormones kicked in and heavy metal really started to take off, and I got my guitar, and I've been doing music ever since.
You wanted to be a football player. Any particular position, team? How did you see yourself?
I wanted to be a wide receiver. I was a giant Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and Lynn Swann, John Stallworth, and these guys were making really dramatic plays, jumping, flying through the air, and it just really, really felt like that would be a great way to live.
When you're a rock musician of your caliber, are you more a wide receiver or a quarterback?
Now I think of myself in terms of soccer. players, and I consider myself kind of a withdrawn striker or a central attacking midfielder. Not the guy who just sits in front of the goal and scores the goal, but the guy who makes that brilliant pass to set someone else up, and that's what I like to do.
Let me ask you to indulge us in listening to another cut, if we could. A song that's rather different in character from a lot of others on the Red Album, and this is Cold Dark World. So what's going on in this song?
Cold Dark World, the music was written by our bass player, Scott, and so it has unusual sound for Weezer. I've written most of the songs for Weezer, and I almost never write in a minor key, but Scott is a very minor key person, so this is a new sound for Weezer. I had been thinking of doing this very a lyric about love and devotion, in a real traditional lyric type of way. But when I combined it with his very dark music, that my lyric took on a very sinister tone that I never intended, but we all thought it was interesting.
By something you told Spin magazine, where you said that you and Weezer could start all over, just change your identities, change your music, try and
yeah. Well, the journalist brought that up. He said, "Do you think you could do this?" And I started thinking about it. It sounded like a very cool challenge. I'd love to try it.
Like going to the witness protection program and
yeah. We can't rely on any of our history, any of our fan base. We have to start over with new identities and try to make it all over again.
What would you do? How would you go about it, you know?
I don't know, because I think it's changed a lot in terms of how a band gets off the ground now. I think a lot of it's through having a MySpace or a website and getting people to view your page and then convincing a record company that means that you can put out an album. I don't really know, but I think it's different from when we started out, which is all about just moving to LA and playing in these clubs and hoping that somebody's out there in the audience that can sign you to their label, passing your demo tape around.
You're going to Harvard when in many ways Weezer had their biggest spurt of popularity.
Yeah, I've gone back a couple times, once right after the big success of our first album, then again in the late 90s, and then again after the Beverly Hills thing. So I keep going back there, but now I finally graduated, so they won't take me back anymore.
Well, I mean, look, that sounds like a sitcom, doesn't it? The rock star goes back to school.
Yeah, it would have been an interesting show, especially when I was living in the dorms.
Well, did people, like, hide out in the bushes or anything?
You know, people were really too cool for school there. You know, no one wanted to look like a fanboy or anything. So I could move amongst the students and be normal, and it was great.
You were, like, 10 years older than a lot of the students, though, weren't you?
Yeah. This last time, I was good 12 years older than most of the other kids, so I probably looked like a grad student or a tutor or something, but... you know, I think everyone probably is self-conscious about something when they're in school or at work or out in public, and I just don't want to let those kinds of things hold me back from doing the things that sound like fun.
Well, Mr. Cuomo, awfully nice talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rivers Cuomo, frontman for Weezer. The band's sixth full-length album, the Red Album, is in stores now. I'm a dude. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Okay, that's the sex. Now the rock and roll. Pop music is filled with singer-songwriters, you know, someone singing along to a piano or a guitar. Kind of a cliche. Well, not this woman, Lily Hayden. David Was has a profile of her.
Rock and roll violinist Lily Hayden has just released her third studio album, Place Between Places, which is quite an accomplishment in and of itself. In a genre better suited to electric guitars jacked up to 11, the 23 inches of fragile spruce and maple that she calls her axe hardly seems fit to compete, much less be heard. Then again, the diminutive 33-year-old has more moxie and attitude than a tour bus full of heavy metal crackheads. Attending a music business powwow some years ago, she sauntered uninvited to the front of the stage and started playing with George Clinton's P-Funk Review. That led to a 2-year residency with the funk ringleader, who has since called Lily Hayden the Jimi Hendrix of the violin. The tough girl, take no prisoners determination may have been a genetic gift from her mother, cult comedian Lotus Weinstock. A former hostess at the Bitter End in 1963, she was famous for making Bob Dylan pay a cover charge when he was trying to get in free. She was also Lenny Bruce's paramour for the last 9 months of his life. It was Lotus who told her daughter to just show up at people's gigs and let them know who she was, a tendency that led her mother to call Lily a jam slut. Such full frontal behavior led to notable gigs like jamming with Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, and recently Roger Waters at Coachella for his recreation of Dark Side of the Moon. On her own album, Lily's gatecrasher persona gives way to the neo-psychedelic flower child just beneath the surface. On the song Children of Babylon, her wispy vocals appeal for an end to warfare, and she's audacious enough to rhyme violins with violence, wishing aloud that the sound of the former could eradicate the latter. Magical thinking at its best. The last track on the album is a cover of George Clinton's Maggot Brain, which features her soloing with the Dhaka Hip Hop Orchestra. The shrinking violet finally disappears altogether, and the rock star virtuoso takes center stage. Her soaring, wah-wah-pedaled violin makes you forget Lily Hayden stands just 5 feet tall and plays with a bow instead of a pick. Heifetz, meet Hendrix.
Hayden's new CD is called Place Between Places. Our reviewer is David Was. He's half of the musical duo Was Not Was.
Back now with Day to Day. T-Bone Burnett is best known as the producer of American roots music, hits like the soundtrack from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. He's also put together a CD by the unlikely musical couple of Led Zeppelin frontman Robert Plant and country bluegrass singer Alison Krauss. But T-Bone Burnett is also an artist in his own right, and he recently released Tooth of Crime. It's a batch of songs he started writing for a Sam Shepard play of the same title back in the 90s. Burnett sat down recently with our music journalist, Christian Bordahl, to discuss the new CD.
People tell me I look like hell. Well, I am hell. In the mid-90s, after producing big hits for artists like Los Lobos, Counting Crows, and Elvis Costello, T-Bone Burnett was ready to hang it all up.
I just said, you know, I'm going to quit, because I was sick of the record business. Everything you made had to fit through a very narrow slot, and it was so restrictive that I wasn't interested in it anymore. I felt that I kept getting given the same jacket to alter, you know, or something like that.
That's when Sam Shepard called to say he was putting on a new version of his play Tooth of Crime in New York and asked Burnett to write the music.
So I said yes immediately, because it seemed like, you know, it was exactly the thing that was in my history. It was in a new direction, and it was in a direction of complete freedom. Like, what is this play going to be? What's the music on this play going to be? It doesn't have to fit anything. It doesn't matter. It can be anything.
Outside the law, we struck with wild desire, we blinded all we saw, we made the sun on fire.
Tooth of Crime tells the story of an aging rock star who gets challenged to a kind of musical duel to the death by an up-and-comer who wants to take his place. Below the surface, however, the play tackles a wide range of issues, like the isolation and corrupting influence of fame, and the narrow labeling of styles and marketing distortions of pop culture. It felt personally relevant to Burnett in the 90s, but he says the play is even more relevant to society today, and that was a message he now felt motivated to deliver.
The press had completely abdicated its role as the guardian of the democracy. It had turned into the media and was just doing nothing except creating celebrity. Okay, so there's no press anymore. The government's gone insane, so there's no government anymore. Who's going to say something? Somebody's going to say something. It felt like, to me, like there was a tremendous responsibility falling on the artists to say something.
It's the Red Age.
Burnett has been on a crusade against digital music recording and what it's done to two-dimensionalized sound. But at the same time, he loves the democratization of music that's been made possible by digital files sent over the World Wide Web.
Let's see where the artists come out of this with this freedom. Let's see what happens. I think the artists are going to save us. You know, that's my hope. I feel like all the leverage is swung to the artists, because none of this huge machine they've built works without what they call content.
Is this not the Red Age, the demented photostat age, the time of no room? We've broken the genetic code and left it bleeding by the road where murderers loom.
For his entire career, T-Bone Burnett has been fighting to broaden people's ideas of what can be considered popular music. And he's been surprisingly successful, helping to produce hits out of obscure roots music like the bluegrass of O Brother Where Art Thou and the proto-rockabilly of Robert Plant and Alison Krauss's Raising Sand. But Burnett has always been a somewhat reluctant lead singer.
I like it better when I'm not singing. I like it better working with Robert and Allison and listening to them sing. You know, I love that.
As a solo artist, Burnett has never really found a unique personal style. His adaptability is part of what makes him a good producer, but it leaves him a little too nondescript to be a good frontman. His voice has the same high, reedy quality as Roy Orbison's, who also was a native of Fort Worth, Texas. And, in fact, during a songwriting lesson Orbison gave there just before his death, he collaborated with Burnett on a melody that later became a song called Killzone on Tooth of Crime.
I didn't want to do anything with it. You know, it was this melody I was holding and I loved and I wanted to take care of, but I didn't want to really do anything with it until this play came along. And the feeling of the melody fit the world and the atmosphere of the play.
Sleeping,
Sam Shepard's play, Tooth of Crime, is an uncompromising, confrontational work, and T-Bone's music for it is a throwback to a time when art did not compose itself around what might be saleable. Gut Bucket Blues is the foundation of Tooth of Crime, but twisted in different directions. Having been conceived as part of a play, some of the songs stand alone better than others, but Burnett is unconcerned. At the age of 60, with all the successes he's achieved as a producer, he feels he's entered a place of freedom to do whatever he wants, and he intends to take advantage. For NPR News, this is Christian Bordahl.
T-Bone Burnett's new CD is called Tooth of Crime. If you'd like to hear some songs off the album, go to our website. That's npr.org/music. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. New York City's Vision Festival tonight honors saxophonist Kid Jordan. Jordan is a legend in avant-garde jazz circles. Musically, Jordan's a bit of a contradiction. He lives in New Orleans, where jazz tends to sound like this. But Kid Jordan's music is entirely improvised. NPR's Netta Ulaby visited New Orleans. She talked with Jordan about what it's like to be a musical maverick.
Kid Jordan, a vowed contrarian, could care less about being popular. He just does what he does, even if that means being part of a tiny club of cranky purists.
The majority of people need somebody else to say yes to what they're doing. They need somebody to pat them on the back and say, oh, man, so and so and so. But when somebody starts patting me on my back, and I start moving away from them and say, no, I'm not supposed to be here.
Why?
Because what I'm doing, how can I say it? If the majority like it, then I'm supposed to go the other way.
Edward Kid Jordan was born in Rice Country, Crowley, Louisiana. As a kid, he used to listen to Charlie Parker albums that black GIs brought home after the war. Jordan thought he'd work with horses like his father, went to college instead, studied music, and wound up playing jazz professionally. His progressive tastes did not sit well with conservative Southern audiences.
We used to play for balls, you know, here in New Orleans, and people tell me, well, don't go too far out now, man. Solo. I would be downstairs practicing, and they would people say, man, why not? Go give him something. Stop him from practicing. Give him some chicken. Put some chicken in his mouth. And they give me one solo a night. That's all I needed.
To support himself, Jordan played in pit bands for shows on tour. It helped that he knew how to read music, and backed up musicians like Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin. Jordan never minded playing conventional music as long as he respected the musician.
I remember one time I did a recording with Albert King, and Albert King said, wine and whiskey is all I crave. I want a big leg woman to carry me to my grave. When he said that, my horn fell out of my mouth, the inflections that he had on it.
Born on the bad side. I've been down since I began to crawl.
And he knew he messed me up that day. Wow, the way he said it. I mean, that was the really, really the blues.
That ain't no lie.
You might have been better known if you'd moved to Chicago or New York or...
Might have.
Why didn't you?
Well, really, my family's here, my friends are here. And if you've got an idea what you want to do, I think you can do it in the wilderness. You can do it in Egypt somewhere, in the desert, and make it happen in your kitchen. I used to feel better in my kitchen than in New York City sometimes. I mean, when you're really playing, it doesn't matter where you're at.
That said, Jordan is the patriarch of a large and highly musical New Orleans family. One daughter plays violin, another sings, one son plays flute, and his son Marlon plays trumpet. They've performed and recorded together. Jordan's family also includes hundreds and hundreds, even thousands, of students, including Branford and Wynton Marsalis. Jordan started Southern University's jazz program and taught there for decades. Jordan's good friend, Clyde Kerr, is a jazz trumpeter and fellow educator. He says Jordan's the kind of prophet who doesn't get the respect he deserves, even in his own town.
Kid is a New Orleans musician, but a lot of people in this town have a certain idea about what is a New Orleans musician or what is New Orleans music, you know. It has to be a certain way.
Still, Kid Jordan wrote this song, Kid Jordan's Second Line, for the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, whose musicians were local kids he helped mentor. They, like so many, many others, were dispersed by Hurricane Katrina. Jordan lost his home in the Upper Ninth Ward. He and his wife evacuated in record time, he says, because he knew all the country back roads from touring them as a musician. But his son Marlon was driven to his roof by the flood for 5 days.
That's the only way he could survive, by busting a hole in the roof. And then he got hungry up there, and he swam across the street to my sister-in-law's house, thought he could find some food in there. When he got in there, the refrigerator was floating around in the house. Then he swam to my daughter's house down the block, and the same thing happened there. And he encountered alligators, dead bodies floating, and all of that. And the helicopters kept passing him by.
Less than a month later, Kid Jordan went into the studio and recorded a melancholy and angry album called Palm of Soul. Jordan lives now in Baton Rouge. He'd love to return to New Orleans, but financially it's too hard. Still, he says he doesn't care where he lives, just as long as he can play.
And like when I practice, I don't practice songs. Now around here they may have some birds in the trees. I may play off of the birds. I may do things like that. Imitating and playing off it and doing this. And that's some natural music. If I get to the points where birds are, I would be ready to go. Say, Lord, take me. I'm ready. Because that's some serious music.
Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You can discover more music by the New Orleans saxophonist Kid Jordan on our music site. That's npr.org. Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Corey Turner, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Bill Deputy. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson. At the national desk, Steve Drummond, Uri Berliner, Ron Elving, Kathy Shaw, Beth Donovan, Ken Rudin, Quinn O'Toole, Elisa Barba, Kate Kincannon, and Evie Stone. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Everybody's talking about name of that song is Teenage Riot. The name of the album is Daydream Nation, and the name of the band is Sonic Youth. Sonic Youth are so influential to many thousands of bands who cite them as an influence that no doubt all those bands are rolling their collective eyes because we played Sonic Youth's best-known songs. Perhaps it's their most accessible song. Well, that's how it goes in the world of indie rock. The name of our guest is David Brown, author of the new Sonic Youth biography, Goodbye 20th Century. Thanks for coming in, David.
Glad to be here, Mike.
Sonic Youth came out of the New York rock scene or new wave scene or kind of pre-punk scene in the late 70s, early 80s. It was a moment, a really brief moment in time, right, that they helped dub No Wave. And I know Thurston Moore, who's a vocalist and guitarist for Sonic Youth, has a book out about No Wave. Why am I hearing about this now for the first time? Like, where did No Wave go and why is it coming back?
In part, you know, it's a nostalgia for a period of time in New York, that late 70s, early 80s period when you had an incredibly vibrant art scene. You had musicians and artists and painters and all these people coming together downtown especially and creating this, you know, kind of fringe community that still reverberates in the culture. You know, it's just it's a nice period to recall when fringe artists could move to New York and kind of get by on like day jobs and $100 a month apartments.
did No Wave and by extension Sonic Youth, when they first started, did they stand for anything or was mostly in a reaction to something?
That's a good question. I think they basically felt that rock and roll by the late 70s had reached a dead end and it needed something new. And so they thought, well, it's just like throw everything out the window and the start from scratch. And if we want to use a power drill plugged into an amplifier on stage, why not?
That was a thing. That was a device they sometimes relied on. But how would you define their sound overall?
The sound overall is it's almost unclassifiable in a way. It's a sound rooted in guitars that are tuned differently than your standard tuning. So they sound maybe to outsiders slightly out of tune. It's a kind of a mass of guitars.
Like every guitar, the strings go, what is it, E, A, D? I don't play guitar. I'm trying to do this from memory,
right,
from like when I did. But they just tune their guitars so the strings don't even sound like that, for
right,
instance.
Each one is tuned in a different way so that when you strum it, it creates all kinds of new overtones. The guitars sound much more expansive. And also, you know, the songs can quote-unquote rock, but at the same time, we're halfway through, the whole thing can just crumble into this, like, chaotic, feedback-y, you know, muddle almost, and then the song will slowly come back together. It's almost like a noise version of a jam band or something.
What's a good version of song, maybe an early song that does that?
You could probably go back to their Evol record, a song like Tom Violence, or even, there are just so many of those kinds of songs.
Let's hear Tom Violence from Evol. All right, let's talk about the people in the band.
Okay.
Who were they? Where'd they come from? How'd they meet?
The three founding members are Thurston Moore, who grew up in Bethel, Connecticut, Kim Gordon, who was raised in California, and Lee Rinaldo from Long Island, from Glen Cove. They're the core of the group, but the real genesis of the band was Kim and Thurston, who were two outside kids interested in the arts and some kind of career in the arts and some kind of life in the arts. Both came to New York in the late 70s. Kim moved here for good in 1980, actually. They met a few months later. They were both, you know, in their early 20s, became a couple pretty quickly, and within a few months started playing music together, even though neither of them ever had a music lesson in their life. And that was just typical of the scene back then. And if you just wanted to, like, bang away on your instrument, even if it was in tune or out of tune or a chord or not, it didn't matter so much as the energy that you were conveying.
You know, so you mentioned that Kim and Thurston, they felt like outsiders, and as much as they did and always have and kind of want to keep that status, they're kind of fascinated by pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Madonna, they had a whole Mariah Carey song or period.
Yep.
And in fact, they even cover Madonna, Into the Groove. Let's listen to that. What do you think they're trying to do there?
They're doing something that was unique at the time. We're talking the mid-80s, and as another sign of their influence, they were bringing this kind of ironic, deadpan pop culture appreciation and humor. The sense of, oh, this mass culture thing is kind of cheesy, but we love it, and we're just going to revel in it.
Now, they're not adverse to fame or success.
Right.
They put one of their best known songs on the new Guitar Hero soundtrack, and that's a song called Cool Thang. Those of you playing Guitar Hero 3 along at home, that one goes red, yellow, red, yellow, green, red, yellow, red, yellow. Let's talk about their influence for a moment. One of the things that has been noted is that they're a really influential band, and yet not a whole lot of bands who they influence sound actually like them.
Exactly.
Why?
I think they're one of the most influential bands in rock history, but not in the typical way you'd expect. It's true. There aren't like 127 Sonic Youth copy bands out there. And part of that is the actual sound, those guitar tunings and things like that.
It's hard to play the drill.
It is. Their influence is much broader in a way. Their influence is showing bands, younger bands, dating back from the early 90s up through now, that you can kind of work within the system and still do what you do and still maintain your credibility. Their influence is in all the people, the younger artists, not just musicians, but directors and illustrators and painters who they've brought along with them into the mainstream.
Another reason they're influential is they usually don't go long periods without a record every couple of years. Mm-hmm. Like I said, very professional.
Mm-hmm.
I think their last record was in 2006, Rather Ripped.
Yep.
Let's hear some of that. Incinerate. Accessible compared to, you know, stuff they were doing 20 years ago.
It was, and it's a perfect example of the left turns that Sonic Youth always managed to take. I mean, in one hand, there's something very traditional about Sonic Youth. They still have the two guitar, bass, and drum lineup. They're not using, you know, synthesizers and mashups and whatever else. They're kind of traditionalists at this point in time. Yet they always come up with some new twist on their, you know, their quote unquote formula. And that record, Rather Ripped, in 2006, actually had these sort of hooky little songs. You know, my daughter, who was a couple years old at the time, actually liked that song, Incinerate. She said everything else was noisy, but she would actually sing along with the chorus of that, which I found really amazing.
All right, David Brown is a longtime music writer and the author of Goodbye 20th Century, a biography of Sonic Youth. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.